Hi, thank you for joining us at U Inc. My name is Rhea Greif, and I'm here with you today, as I am every week, to help build the most important brand in your life, which is you. When we talk about building, we use tools, and the same goes for building our brand. These wellness tools will help elevate your emotional intelligence and help to lead you in a more positive, successful direction in life and in business. Some of these tools you will find helpful today, and some you might save to ponder while on sabbatical. This week's tool is religion, and why it is important to learn how to reconsider religion and all its meanings, and being able to do so is what I will show you is a great tool for your brand. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight, losing my redemption. Religion is such a touchy subject, and I don't endeavor to make a career out of it like Sam Harris. But speaking of Sam Harris, let's take a look at this critic of religion and proponent of the liberty to criticize religion's journey. In 2004, he wrote the book The End of Faith. In this book, Sam Harris delivers a startling analysis of the clash between reason and religion in the modern world. He offers a vivid historical tour of our willingness to suspend reason in favor of religious beliefs, even when these beliefs inspire the worst human atrocities. In other words, he articulates the dangers and absurdities of organized religion so fiercely and so fearlessly that it has resonated with a sizable number of individuals to catapult him to fame and a guru of sorts in his own right, which is ironic to say the least. But for Sam Harris, that was not the end, because he realized that for 25% of Americans who follow no religion, that they, including myself, suspect that important truths can be found in the experiences of such figures such as Jesus, Buddha, Rumi, and other saints and sages of history. So, 10 years later, he wrote a new book admitting that spirituality is essential and atheism just doesn't cut it. In 2014, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality, Harris argues that there is more to understanding reality than science and secular culture generally allow, and that how we pay attention to the present moment largely determines the quality of our lives. Which brings us to freedom of religious expression, what our country was founded on. In December of 1657, a letter was written to protest Peter Stuyvesant's harsh treatment of Quakers, which, by the way, Sam Harris is a descendant of, as a reminder that the colonies were promised to be a place for love, peace, and liberté, and all members were to be left alone to enjoy religious freedom. This remonstrance is the first public expression of a desire for the freedom of religion written on American soil before it was even officially America, and is considered an important precedent for the Constitution's Bill of Rights for an incredible historical perspective on how America came to be, and this founding principle to our Constitution and the history of immigration. The book, City of Dreams, by Tyler Ann Binder, is a must-read. And you can find the links to these books, as well as all of our peer-reviewed articles we discuss on U Inc. on wcbe.org/programs/U-Inc., as well as full podcasts of all our episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. According to an article in The Atlantic, religion has made a comeback in 2017, but not in a good way. Nationalism, often expressed in religious terms, is a key organizing principle of the current administration and Green Rights, which is why so many have seen religion as being divisive, destructive, and dumbing down societies currently and historically. The antidote is education, according to Richard Dawkins, described as one of the four horsemen of new atheism, which also includes Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, and the aforementioned Sam Harris. Richard Dawkins believes that education is the only antidote to religion, that we need to protect children from being indoctrinated. Mr. Dawkins says, if children are taught, however moderately, that faith is a virtue, they are taught that they don't need evidence to believe something, and that they can believe something just because it's their faith, then that paves the way for the minority to become extremists. If children are taught that they don't need to defend their beliefs with evidence, then that does pave the way for extremism. With education, he believes that atheism will soon become a more popular framework for people, and that there seems to be a correlation with education that the more educated people are more likely to give up religion. This, of course, does not mean giving up spirituality, as we have seen, or believing in something. It is just cause for pause to rethink religion and perhaps reshape the way we express our gratitude for this gift called life. Try and penetrate with our limited means the secrets of nature, and you will find that behind all the discernible concatenations, there remains something subtle, intangible, and inexplicable. Veneration for this force beyond anything that we can comprehend is my religion, to the extent that I am, in point of fact, religious. And that is a quote from Albert Einstein in response to atheist Alfred Kerr in 1927, quoted in the Diary of a Cosmopolitan by Harry Kessler, who wrote about everything he observed from a period from 1918 to 1937, including Einstein's long discussions about his theories. Today, we do have someone who is making a career partly based out of the history of religion and is inarguably an authority on the subject. His most recent book, Modernism After the Death of God, Christianity, Fragmentation, and Unification, which explores the work of seven influential modernists and the threat they believe that Christian sexual morality posed in their lives, is an incredible undertaking of religion and its influences throughout history. Dr. Stephen Kern is a humanities distinguished professor in the Department of History at The Ohio State University and has also written seven books on modernism. He is originally from Los Angeles but currently lives in Columbus, is married with wife Sydney and two children, Simone and Justin, and has a new grandchild named Ramona. Welcome, Dr. Kern.
Happy to be here.
Okay, Dr. Kern. This is kind of one of those left field kind of questions. How did the Bible come about being placed in hotel rooms?
I don't know.
No idea at all.
I know the Gideon Society did it.
I've always wondered about that. Like, how did that begin to happen and why they started putting that in there? No idea at all.
As I said, Gideon Society.
What is the Gideon Society?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Okay. So we spoke of Sim Harris earlier. And in reading your most recent book, Introduction, where it chronicles the relationship of seven modernists and how the relationship to religion went from a hostile one, sort of, to an acceptance in terms of its role in everyday life. I mean, I feel kind of as if Sam Harris also went through this trajectory. Do you think this is kind of the natural progression when someone begins to question religion, that they have this antagonistic relationship and they kind of come around later on?
Yeah, let me just correct one little thing.
Sure.
These people didn't start out hostile to religion.
Okay.
Most of them began immersed in religion. Nietzsche came from five generations of Lutheran ministers. When he read from Scripture in church, people wept. He was deeply admired in it, and that's the reason his criticism, I think, is so powerful, that he knew where he was coming from. And this is true of D.H. Lawrence. It's true of Gide. It's true of many of the several that I was discussing. They did react negatively, and there was a lot of things they didn't like about it. I do single out the thing that they didn't just lose their faith. They became militantly anti-Christian. They thought that Christianity was harmful, and that so goes beyond just mere atheism. And the central thing that accounts for the vehemence was that they thought that the sexual morality, the emphasis on sin, in the Western church at least, in the Eastern church it's not quite so focused on sexuality, would threaten to damage their love life.
Mm-hmm.
And it infuriated them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, James Joyce, who went to Jesuit college and Jesuit schools, referred to the Catholic Church when he broke away as a big whore. Nietzsche was utterly contemptuous. He was particularly contemptuous of the image of the Christ on the cross, the crucifixion. And he thought that it was not something that offered people atonement and salvation, but it made them feel helpless. It reminded them of how bad they were. I mean, how bad do you have to be if God has to sacrifice himself and be tortured to death for your sins,
right,
that you cannot atone for? And other reasons, but a lot of them centered on, this was my discovery in looking at this. So they began, most of them began committed to Christianity. They turned away, but they didn't detach entirely. They remain attached. And their relationship throughout their life was a fairly complicated one. Nietzsche admired priests. He disliked priests, but he admired them. He admired them for their dedication. They could discipline themselves over a long period of time. They were very profound in a single direction. Joyce continued to write about Catholicism in his novels. D.H. Lawrence, who resented that he was douched in Congregationalism, that he could recall pages and pages of the Book of Revelation with nauseating fixity, his term. Nevertheless, he wrote it on the hymns he learned as a boy. He loved those. He liked the sayings of Jesus. He liked images of resurrection, but not the crucifixion. Mm. They make these distinctions. Nietzsche's last book is titled The Antichrist. Yes, he's the Antichrist. He was Antichrist. Christ was not a Messiah. Christ can't save you. But he liked Jesus. He admired Jesus. Mm. Jesus was a model of an overman because Jesus would write with his blood, metaphorically speaking. This is one of the things that Nietzsche admires in the artist, someone who gives themselves fully, as Jesus did. So a very complicated, nuanced relationship. As far as Sam Harris goes, yeah, I thought his book was too bitingly negative. I wasn't working at it at the time. And if he wrote a book 10 years later saying I was wrong, well, so what? I work through this with I'm a historian. I'm not a moralist.
Right.
I'm not here to tell people what they should or should not do. I'd study this period, 1900 and 1940, mainly Europe, and I'm reporting what the leading cultural figures of the period believed.
Right.
And they did reject it. They did sort of retain it, but they're not famous for their Christianity. Mm-hmm. They're famous for what they put in its place.
Yeah.
What do you do when the unifying worldview of Christianity, which is in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in the end, the righteous are going to be with Jesus and God for eternity.
Right.
That's a powerful narrative. That is very comforting if people believe that. Well, the people that I was studying couldn't believe that. But there's a need for unity. There's a need for wholeness. And they sought it in other areas. I discussed two philosophers, four novelists, and a psychiatrist. Freud wasn't a Christian. He was Jewish. But for all of them, and this is my subtitle on fragmentation and unification, they did fragment this experience. They did reject the totalizing, unified narrative of a religion. Just the concept of a religion was anathema to them. But they did need to break things up, but put them together. And this is another feature of the book that is original or controversial, because most people in discussing the 20th century say it's a time of cultural fragmentation. The grand narratives, the Enlightenment narrative, the liberal narrative, more people voting, progress of science, and behind this, the religious narrative, are rejected. And my argument is, and I had an epiphany in researching this. I was in climbing a mountain in France, and Mont Saint-Victoire, and which Cézanne painted many times in the last 25 years of his life, and I got near the top, and I looked out, and I had this epiphany, and I realized that modernism was about unification, because the mountain unified the world. Right. You could see it from everywhere. It could be seen from everywhere, and Cézanne painted it increasingly abstract style, which allowed him, abstraction allows you to, he never went completely abstract, but more abstract, allows you to unify the picture surface. So anyway, the whole thing came together. Yes, it's unification. People just don't fragment.
Right.
They don't just not believe. They need to pull the stuff together. And so that's the other argument of the book.
So when you say they unified, what was their thinking afterwards? How were they able to ameliorate that, the rejection, and then be able to get back into it?
For Nietzsche, he proposed, he was a moralist, the life of the overman or the superman. This is someone who achieves greatness, authenticity, and meaning, not goodness. Mm. In fact, he writes a book titled Beyond Good and Evil, which is dangerously misinterpreted as a recommendation that you go out and do evil. Nothing could be more incorrect.
Right.
You don't get beyond good and evil by killing somebody, but it's not enough just to be good.
Right.
You know, I ask my students, what makes you cry? What moves you to tears? You know, well, it's usually a concert they've gone to or a movie, right? No one ever cries watching someone go into a church. None of my students ever cry watching people vote. Then none of them cry watching people do good deeds. Although you may be moved, that's a little borderline maybe. So being good, just doesn't do it. So they turned to art, to literature, I don't deal with any painters or musicians, two philosophers, and Freud, psychiatry. And what was Freud's psychiatry about? You take people apart, psychoanalysis,
right,
and then you put them together. In fact, I said he should have called it psychosynthesis. You know, it isn't just fragmentation. But the model of the tremendously powerful unifying, and not just the narrative of history, but the morally unifying. You have the Ten Commandments. You have God's law. You need to be a good Christian. What does that mean? Well, we want to be like Jesus. Well, you know, it means, it doesn't mean just do good deeds. It means a certain way of living, mm-hmm. a way of cultivating your humanity and be willing to die for what you believed in. That Nietzsche found that admirable. So these are the sources. These are the replacements, literature, art. You know, and Nietzsche says, look to the artist if you want to understand the way to the overman and see what the artist does. They go through three metamorphoses. You have to be like a camel, like a lion, and a child. You got to be like a camel because you got to learn to bear a load over a long period of time in a single direction. And as I'm saying this, think of a ballet dancer. Think of what a ballet dancer goes through. You got to bear a load. You got to deal with your teachers. You got to get strength. You got to get flexibility. You got to build your repertoire over a long period of time. So you got to be like a camel. That's not enough. Then you got to be like a lion. You got to learn to say no. No to your teacher. And that's hard after 8-10 years of admiring someone and having a mentor to say no.
Right.
You got to find your own way. And then it's not enough just to say no. You have to learn to say yes again. And you have to be like a child. A camel, a lion, a child. The yes, a new innocence, a new affirmation of life, a new sense of joy. In fact, Nietzsche's motto was love thy fate. You know, love your life. Don't let your life be a regret. And you have to cultivate your humanity. And for him, Christianity was not the way to do that.
Right. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about where you stand on religion, if you don't mind sharing.
Well, I'm an atheist. Right. I grew up without religion, basically. And so there you have it. And mm-hmm. But I'm writing this as a historian. I'm reporting what these dead people did, you know, and I'm not moralizing. There's not a single sentence that's explicitly moralistic in the whole book. This is what they did. And by the way, this isn't just these seven. I have a list in my conclusion of 70 people, 70 leading modernists who are either atheists or agnostics. Now, there is a counter movement, as you had alluded to, mm-hmm. the anti-secularization thesis. The secularization hypothesis was really hot in the 1960s, and there was a big pushback beginning in the 1980s. And I was reading one article in working on this that said that the secularization thesis is dead, that, you know— And, you know, they make reference to, you know, church attendance in the United States today and televangelism and what's going on in the Muslim world and Muslim fanaticism and religion. I'm not writing about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing about what happens in Europe, primarily in Europe,
sure.
from 1900 to 1940. That's my study. And whatever implications you can draw from it, that's another matter.
Gotcha. Okay, let's change the pace a little bit. You're clearly knowledgeable. You received the Rockefeller Fellowship, the Guggenheim Fellowship. You received the Ohio Academy of History Distinguished Historian Award, to name a few. But have you ever heard of RateMyProfessor.com?
Yes.
Okay. You did better than me, just so you know. You did really well. But let me talk about just some of the negative comments, and there's a reason behind it.
Uh-huh.
So it says, what seems like an interesting history class turned into preaching on all subjects. He goes off on tangents. No PowerPoints. Dr. Kern is arrogant. So why I bring this up, do you think that sometimes having such a depth of knowledge of a subject can lead to one of those can't see the forest for the trees? For example, can passion get in the way of teaching the way that passion of belief can get in the way of rational thinking?
Sure.
Okay.
And let me just say, there are other evaluations on there.
Oh,
no,
they were all wonderful.
Yeah.
So, no, it's like I said, you did way better than me.
You know, you get the over the top positive, the over the top negative.
No, you were 4 out of 5. You're amazing.
Most people just right. don't bother, but I have to say that.
Right. No.
I'm arrogant and I'm opinionated, and there's certain people who really are ticked off by that.
Sure.
And I'm also very critical on writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I correct pronouns and commas and punctuation. And
I think you should.
And I mean, I'm scrupulous about that. Mm-hmm. So, and people really don't like that. And I say, well, this is an English class. I thought I was taking a history
yeah.
class. So I said, no, this is a, well, never mind.
Okay. So one of the comments mentioned that your lectures turn to the subject of sex. In your book, you mentioned that religion squashed the sexual freedoms of modern intellectualists, and that's the reason why they turned away from it. So in your estimation,
love. It was their love life.
Okay.
You know, their sex life too,
okay.
of course. But let me just say, and this is when you're reading like that chapter in Joyce mm-hmm. On the retreat, sex is the instinct that keeps the species going.
Right.
It evolved for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And it's these young boys are experiencing this. It's coursing through them. And then they have these strictures against them. In fact, one of my people, Andre Gide, said, you know, God, why did you do this to me? Why did you give me these instincts that, you know, if I satisfy them, I'm going to go to hell forever?
Yeah.
So, but it's about their love life. Mm-hmm. It isn't just...
Okay. You're basically answering the question I was about to ask. So based on your extensive research, so do you think that the natural state of human sexuality, love life, for example, what do you think religion has done to that? Because you talked about instinct, like exactly what we're just talking
about.
Well,
you know, let's be balanced here.
Okay.
In the Christian church, that, you know, the original sin was originally disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only with Augustine in the 5th century it becomes concupiscence, which is lust, all kinds of lust, but primarily sexual lust. And people have argued that, you know, women were fair game walking along a road in the 5th century. Christianity had a way of protecting women. It had a way of trying to, well, to protect women and to make it less brutal and coarse. In my view, it went, you know, to extreme, you know, and I don't want to get started on this, but even Joyce mentions that in this 3-day retreat, a priest is warning them about the dangers of sex. These are guys who are also going to brothels. Not a word about syphilis. That's criminal.
Right. That's irresponsible. Right.
Yeah, it's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a good word. And so, and there's other issues on sexuality. And it's just, I think it's a very complicated matter.
Mm-hmm.
But on balance, I think it has had a very destructive effect, certainly in the period I was concerned about, and this is the view of these individuals who were committed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Andre Gide was a homosexual, and so he was triply troubled by his desires, by his masturbation, by his homosexuality, and his adultery. He committed adultery in pursuing his homosexual activities, and he had a tortured life. Probably his most famous book is his journal, 4 volumes of the journals of Andre Gide. It's just full of just, oh, God, why did you do this to me? And he's fighting with the devil, with the it just breaks your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts some of this in his novels. One novel is Straight as the Gate. It's about a young couple, and they're in love, and they're both religious. She's more religious than he is. She's so religious, so ascetic, that she not only becomes antisexual, but she won't let him touch her. She doesn't want his body to be near her, you know, and eventually she comes to turn on her own body and basically wastes away and dies.
Mm.
It's just asceticism becoming lethal. And only Andre Gide could write this.
Right.
I mean, you know, that
this And that really happened?
It's a novel.
Oh, it's a novel. Okay, sorry. Okay.
Well,
Initially it was his journal, but sorry, it was his novel.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's a novel he wrote, Straight as a Gate. And it was based on experience.
Mm.
His wife, he had an unconsummated marriage, a 45-year marriage.
What?
Unconsummated.
Wow.
And he loved her like no one else. She was the love of his life. It's a very complicated story. And one day she found some love letters to a young man, and she didn't talk to him for months. And he came back and he said, "Where are my letters to you?" Which he thought were the greatest thing he's ever written. She had reread. He asked for the key to the desk where they were locked in because he wanted it for something he was writing. And she went blank. She blanched, and she said, she explained to him that she read every one of them and threw them into the fire one by one. But he was tortured by her death and her loss. So complicated.
Wow.
I'm digressing.
Wow. Okay. All right. So I saw a Vimeo of you talking about how you consider war to be an interrupter and simply about killing, which I agree with. Would it be fair to say that most war, and based again on your studies...
I'm sorry. What?
You had said something that war is an interrupter of
war.
Time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, war.
War. Yeah. It was an interrupter of time, and it was just simply about killing, which I agree with. And would it be fair to say that most war in history has its root cause in religion, since we're talking about religion?
In religion?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I don't know enough to say that.
Okay.
Lots of wars have been caused by religion, lots of long-standing wars, and fiercely vicious wars. I mean, mm-hmm. There's no room for compromise. There's no diplomacy. If you're doing God's work, you know, and you're going to go to hell if you don't do God's work. This is the danger of religious wars. They are very, very dangerous wars. But I wouldn't say all wars are caused by it. In looking at this whole period, I see war basically just interrupts the creative work that is underway.
So you're on sabbatical right now. Congrats. What are some plans that you have for this time? For example, will you be trying to learn more about quantum physics, for example?
No, definitely not. I did a book 35 years ago called The Culture, Time, and Space, 1880 to 1918, which dealt with the impact of technologies, telephone, wireless, automobile, airplane, on the experience of time and space in that period. It's by far and away my most successful book. And I'm returning to, there's no really word for it, updating it in a sense to the last 40 years. So it's I tend to write title The Culture, Time, and Space, 1980 to 2018. I may not use that title because it may get lost on Amazon. But it is going to be the exact same subtopics fleshed out 100 years later.
Do you have a goal for a completion date?
Nope.
Okay. Okay, I like that. Okay, one last thing. You mentioned that you took a poetry workshop and that you came up with some, and I quote, non-academic similes. Can you share one with us?
Yeah. I say that the explorers, the Michelson-Morley experiment. This was an experiment done in the, 1885 or something to check for an ether, the luminiferous ether through which light passed, and they didn't detect anything. And physicists tried to struggle for a long time trying to reconcile the yield of that experiment with physics. And one person hypothesized that the apparatus shrank, contracted in the exact motion in which the Earth was moving and to compensate, Einstein came along and just relativized time and space. But I referred to these physicists trying to reconcile like a squirrel trying to bury a nut in a tile floor. What?
I think it's great.
Yeah, and I was looking. I had a lot of squirrels outside my window. But you see, academics don't do that, and poets do.
Right.
I've been going through the book because I'm rewriting the book now, and there must be 50 of those. You know, I talk about the African explorers. You know, in the early part of the 19th century, they took nibbles at the African cookie. Now that's rather irreverent, but if you look at a map of Africa in 1812 or 15, there's these little nibbles around the edge. Well, you just wouldn't do that. That's not an academic thing. You
know? Right.
My dissertation advisor would not let that go. You know?
Maybe you should do a little short little book afterwards with all of them just for fun.
Well, I've lost it. I've become a dry as dust academic once again.
Well, you were certainly entertaining today, Dr. Kern.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming on U Inc.
My pleasure.
From our person on the street.
So, Ashley, what are your thoughts on religion?
My thoughts on religion are, I grew up going to church every Sunday, and I still go to church when I go home for the holidays and everything like that. I do believe that there's a God up there that has a plan for me, and just thinking that he's in my life every day.
So you said when you went home for the holidays, what kind of religious activities did you engage in?
Yeah, so I went to church on Christmas Eve most recently. So we did some carols and they read some stories that relate to Jesus' birth and things like that. So just more about the time and the religion around Christmas.
So what are some other ways that you practice religion while you're here?
While I'm here, I would say I try and keep religion in my goals for my work and in my success and in my life. So I just always have that in kind of the back of my mind.
So it's like a kind of a life purpose more than just like an act in a church.
Yeah, correct. Since I've been to college and things like that, I don't necessarily go to church every day, but I do still say I practice religion in my everyday life.
So do I. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's our show for today, folks. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Rhea Greif, and you've been listening to U Inc. on 90.5 WCBE.